Welcome, everyone. This is the fourth in the series of five talks on contemplating death and dying, or using our spiritual practice, embracing death as our spiritual practice. And I hope by this time you begin to feel where these talks are going. They're not going to let you out of the death grasp. I have warned some of you, and some of you I'm hearing feedback are sometimes getting a little shaky in this subject, where you're finding nightmares arising and just maybe a more anxiety in the course of the day. And I'll deal next week, not next week, but in 2 weeks, with the evolution of how this subject, the mind works with this subject over time, and the fear, the grasp that fear has early on is not the end of the way that it helps us along. It's the beginning. But almost all of us have to go through that initial reaction to get to the side where we really begin to feel the harmony of and living with this subject. The ego grasps it very firmly in the beginning. It either loves it or hates it. Either way, it makes something very special out of it. And it kind of exaggerated significance to it. I remember my own hospice work in the first 6 months. Most people who go through hospice work went through what I went through, which was this kind of just gloom that pervades your life for the first 6 months. And my first 6 months ended around Christmas time, and I couldn't believe anybody would be happy at Christmas when I was as miserable and had seen the misery I had seen. And so the ego loves to make this into something special, into a sort of like the big task at hand to work on its own demise. So there's a little bit of humor that needs to go along with that, and just okay, just relax here. And if nightmares are occurring, may I say they're also occurring with me. In fact, a couple of nights ago I had a nightmare in which I was in a room, building, with other people, probably Sangha. And I looked outside and suddenly we were on a hill like this one. And it was a mudslide and the building was going down with the mudslide. So I was watching the passing landscape as the riding the sled of the building down. And then the mud flowed over the building, and suddenly it all got dark, and I realized that I was buried alive. And when I woke up out of it, which I did immediately, which is the case for most nightmares, which I don't like, I just wake up out of them. I realized the suddenness, you know, how this subject is. I've worked with this subject in hospice care. It's sort of a dialogue with death. You know, I've got a couple of months or a month or maybe 6 months to work on this subject of getting myself ready in order to die. But that's not the way most of us die, is it? It's a sudden. It's the law. It's the mudslide. It's the heart attack. It's the sudden stroke. And that we don't have time to prepare for most. We have to. It's an ongoing preparation. All of us. It's ongoing preparation. This dog is taking that to heart. I want to show you a cartoon someone left me in my Donna basket, which I enjoyed. It's a dog speaking to his master and handing his master a card. And the caption reads, it's an organ donor card. If you go first, I'd like to get your bones. So we're all hoping for a prolonged period of time before we know we're going, so we can make our arrangements like that. But tonight's talk is more about how we distort our life by denying death. We've talked about the impact death has when we open up to it. But what about the way most of us live, which is a kind of denial, an ongoing denial, and how this fear creates a kind of leaning into life, or an expectation of life, and a leaning into life, and therefore a distortion of life, and because it's distorted, an overcompensation. That overcompensation is what in Buddhism they call suffering. In fact, the sense of self is itself an embodiment of that overcompensation. The sense of me, as an egoic separate entity, is developed from overcompensation, from that leaning tendency. And there, as I started looking at this subject with some interest, it was hard for me to come, literally, and find any reaction that didn't have some connection with loss or death. And let's throw it all in. Loss is death. So that didn't have some connection with death itself. And what I hope to do today is to show how we are distorting our physical reality, our psychological reality, and our spirituality often around this subject, though it may not be obvious. Perhaps tonight we can make connections to how it is that we are constantly leaning from the fear of our own demise. And it's also worth noting that the Buddha, after being a prince for almost three decades, he ventures out and begins to see life in a clearer, more direct way than he had within the chambers of protected castle walls where he lived most of his life. And I think this is more metaphorical than real, but it doesn't matter. It's a beautiful metaphor. He goes out and he looks and he sees somebody dying, sees somebody sick, sees somebody who's lame, sees how life is actually interfacing with people. He's young. He doesn't feel that in himself. And he goes, "My God, I can't go back in there and hide." He probably didn't say, "My God." But I can't go back in there. I can't pretend. And I get the feeling that something deep was shaken in him. Something rattled its way forward. This is unacceptable to live like this. And so I'm hoping that this subject invites a rattling in us. That rattling is never fun. But change requires some anxiety. If it weren't anxiety provoking or fearful, we'd already be doing it. Whenever you're moving from what you're consistently doing to what you're not doing, but know you need to be doing, there is some reorganization necessary, and that creates anxiety for most of us. So it's not of any surprise that this subject is going to rattle us. It's going to create some anxiety. Again, we have to self-monitor. If it's too much, take yourself out of here, really, literally. And take yourself out of this series and bring it back in when it feels the right timing for you. Never force yourself. It shouldn't feel like I'm doing this, I'm going to whip myself into shape by studying, I need this for my own salvation. That's just egoic. That's the hospice worker before the 6 month. It's the egoic sense of making ourselves special around this subject. It's much more at ease. Like just an invitation. I need to look at this thing. I need to get myself squared with this. That's the way I felt. I don't know enough about this thing, and it's looming. So I gotta get it. I wasn't like the cherry off the cake. I didn't even want it. It was like, it's here. I gotta look at it. That's the way it was. It was like more obvious than anything. And, even if we look how the Buddha framed some of his perceptual, ethical values. He talked about the first precept as being do no violence. And if we can look at some of the subtle ways that that precept really is meant, I believe, for us to engage in, is do no violence or distortion to reality. Because distortion is a violence to reality, is it not? Like we negate what is. We turn away from it. That's a violence. There's a violent act that we do to reality. So the first precept is really, I believe, an invitation to looking at subjects like death and dying so that we will no longer do violence. I could not come up with a single violent act which wasn't caused by some sense of loss in us, by some feeling or a close association with death. And I don't mean physical death. When we're talking about death, we're talking about loss. And so there's constant compensation. We're constantly trying to compensate for this fear of loss. And every battle, argument, struggle that we have in some way is connected, if we look at least as I've looked at it, with a loss. It may be a loss of just an expectation, or it could be something, the loss of an actual loved object. And so the me forms itself as a stance, as a denial to that loss. And therefore, that leaning or denial of the actuality creates the reaction of violence. And suffering, really. So this is not just a small subject we're approaching. In fact, some of you have heard this story. I was doing a retreat in Kansas City and was picked up by a young man. Well, not so young. He was in his mid-40s or late 40s. But he was driving me erratically to the retreat, and erratically meaning he was just tight and tense, kept missing turnoffs and speeding and then going real slow. And I thought he was on drugs, to be honest. And I asked him, I said, wait a second, you know, I value my life. What's going on here? And he said he just got out of prison, where he had been in prison for over 2 decades. And he was feeling the effects of having left prison life. And I said, what do you mean, the effects? And he said, well, every morning before he would go into the exercise yard, because he was a small man, he would stand in front of the mirror and pump himself up. Because he dreaded so going out into the exercise yard where he'd be picked on, he would pump himself up and he would develop this kind of violent tension, and a macho spirit, so he could go out there with some degree of postural acceptance so that people would leave him alone. Well, after you do that for 27 years, he said, when he comes home, he can't stop doing that. And so this level of tension I was feeling in him was what the implication of the denial of being himself for all those years, of being at ease with himself and trying to make himself something he wasn't in character and personality and style. Now, each of us have that kind of leaning residue from where we're trying to lean into ourselves in a particular way, being something we aren't, trying to live an untrue life, to escape ourselves. And the dread, much of the dread we have in living has direct implications to the way we have distorted ourselves all these years. Certainly, this pervasive anxiety that many of us have, just waking up in the morning feeling anxious about nothing, not objectively, we can't say I'm feeling anxious about the meeting today, it's whenever we wake up. Much the same as that man did after he left prison. So this subject at hand brings us into a natural orientation with ourselves. In fact, in hospice care, when someone was relatively young, meaning probably, well, it could be any age, but young so that they weren't expecting to die, and they were dying, at some point they would go into what we would phrase terminal restlessness, which, because they were unable to speak, we couldn't often discern what was troubling them. But I always felt it was that they were inevitably facing the fact that they were going to die, and they weren't, and this physicality of, you could see the physicality of experience. They were rolling and tossing and turning. They tried to stand up, but they were too weak at that point. They'd fall down, and oh, it was just awful to see. And the younger and more vital and the more angry somebody was because they were dying, the more you could assure that that was going to be played out in their restlessness when they were dying. It's so, what we do to ourselves in this culture, and in all cultures, probably, but certainly this one, just by refusing this subject, not willing to orient ourselves to something that is so naturally a part of everything we do. And so, one of the ways we distort our physical reality, and I want to talk about the distorting physical reality, psychological, and spiritual reality, we distort it by making, we think that through dependency, by being dependent upon something, we can, by that forms an artificial connection. See, artificially interconnection is the mind's interpretation of interconnection is dependency. So it can feel immortal, or in some way supported, perhaps is a better word, not so alone by being dependent upon, and which is a reaction again to loss and to death. And what I like about death is it absolutely levels the playing field. There's no uniqueness. There's no, you can't be special on your way, on dying. You know, all of the kings and queens take off their crowns when they die. The pauper and the rich person. And perhaps the pauper has a better advantage without the pretentiousness that has been built around egoically and vanity around the rich. But the distortion that we believe in the meantime, I mean, we are born and then we live seven decades or eight or nine and then we die. So we have 80 or 90 years that we lose ourselves from the bookends of our life. It's as if we forget about the bookends. What were we before we were born? And what will we be after we die? Those are questions that interest me. It's not, if it's just about the bookends, you look around and you say, well, you know, there's only a limited number of books here. And then I get to the bookend. This isn't like a forever journey. It must be about something besides 70 years of frolicking. Right? Spring is here. Because if it's just, you know, if everything is meaningful only for 70 years, if everything is lovable only for 70 years, if everything only has worth for 70 years, it has no worth. Not in absolute terms. In absolute terms is what this practice points. And the psychological distortions we go through. The physical distortions, of course, is pretending that we are younger than we are and, you know, doing all the Botox and all of that, all those distortions. And yet, the inward aging, irreversible. And would you want it any other way? Would you want to find the fountain of youth? I personally feel like this is as hard as it gets. I don't mean my life, but I mean this plane of existence. And that we're quite likely going to have, awareness is going to have a much more openness when it releases the body. I don't know that. But I feel like this is really a working station that we're on. Why prolong work? So, feel the pain associated with the leaning as I go through some of this. And the distortion, and the harder we lean, the greater the tilt of our leaning, the greater the assurance that the fall will occur and it will hurt more when it does occur. And so I just thought, okay, well, let me just look at some of the ways that death is always in front of us psychologically, like when we're lonely. You see what? We feel cut off, don't we? Cut off, that's a death. We feel disconnected. We feel... And so we become very dependent upon others and their sense of us to save ourselves from our own loneliness and to make ourselves acceptable to others so that we won't be lonely. We're willing to lean quite far in either direction. When I was a child, I just remember doing horrible things to get my peers' support. Things I would have never done on my own. And how we use others to fill the void of our own sense of emptiness, our own sense of death. Ellen, my wife, is in clinical pastoral education at Swedish, and she was on call the first time a week or so ago. So, you know, we have the pagers by our bedside. So 1 o'clock in the morning, the pager goes off. Fair enough. So she, 3 hours later, she comes back, and I said, well, what was it? Oh, it was just somebody who was lonely and wanted to talk. We need that. The need is such that you put the whole thing disproportionately. You don't even care whether you're taking somebody out of bed to speak to you, and you speak to them for 3 hours, because the need is such that you don't even, it's not balanced by what you're doing to another person by demanding that connection. And the fear of isolation, the fear of being cut off, the fear of being abandoned, the fear of being dismissed, negated, unacknowledged. These are directly related to death. The issue, yes, there are psychological reasons why we feel abandoned, my mother abandoned, but the issue, if taken far enough, points right to our demise. It's cellular. It goes through the psychological. It's cellular. Abandoned. I'm not included. And all of these things are counteracted through the meditation, because meditation finds a ground for these things, grounds it. You see, when we're able to be present to ourselves, with ourselves, and be connected to the earth as an ongoing reality for ourselves, then these psychological disturbances can't fuse us into action. They don't, they're very workable as emotions in and of themselves. And the discharge of them is very quick when you get it down. But the story around them is so compelling, because that's what we're really afraid of when we're afraid of death, is the loss of our story. That's why death, physical death, holds such trauma. The body, yes, but what about me? The loss of my continuation. Because in our story, how we look at life, how we've infiltrated life with our interpretation, with our meaning, with our importance, with our self-importance, and with our projects and our work and our self-validation and all of that, that's just story. That's just, that dies. That ages. That weakens. Or, for instance, the psychological fear of silence and communication. I like that one. Where there'll be this time, this awkwardness that we feel, and there'll be a psychological implication, like I have little to offer, or some feeling that, you know, I'm as insufficient as I feel in myself. I'm not able to hold up my side of the communication, so this sense of anxiety pervades in that. But really, if I'm not engaged in communication and I'm quiet, that's my implication of my death. So what about spiritual death? It's interesting. We make a lot out of spiritual death, but one of the ways that we can get distorted spiritually is by infusing our spiritual practice with a kind of deity, with a kind of salvation. You know, I need to do this for almost for salvation as a dependency. It can be a dependency on method or teacher or tradition or on just the forms. When if we looked at all these things with some critical eye, which is what meditation really is, an objective eye, we see that all of these things are in transition, they're in movement, they're impermanent. And to rely on them for salvation is an oxymoron, because spirituality is supposed to wake us up to where it is that we're relying on that which can never be relied upon. But we can use our spiritual journey to prop us up, to prop up the me. I remember one example when I was meditating for a prolonged period of time, and one morning I started to actually experience my own death in meditation, and I felt a tremendous pain in the center of my chest and knew that I was having a heart attack, though I knew it wasn't this body that was having a heart attack. It was some memory, not of this lifetime. Tremendous pressure, though. I really know what a heart attack feels like from that experience. And then gasping, and then I died. And the first thought I had when I was on the other side of death was, my God, I wasn't aware. I lost consciousness. I lost awareness. And I thought, you know, be easy here. You see, if we start putting pressure on ourselves, I've got to be more and more aware. I mean, that's the dependency. That's the leaning into something as ephemeral as attention. This is a call back into the relaxation of death, not into trying to make it all work so that at the last moment I've got the spiritual brightness to see what's happening to me, which all of us would love, I'm sure. But that's not the point here. The point is to be life. To be, to abide in life. And it's interesting because we pick a parallel track to life. It's like the sense of me, journey parallel to life. Life is moving, and we are either in dispute of that movement or in accordance with it. But it's like a video game. We're trying to stay on the road, but have the road go according to how we want it to turn. So it's kind of like parallel paths. Life and me. We don't really feel a part of life because we're constantly complaining about the curves and the dead ends and the pitfalls and the cliffs. And spirituality is the journey to make the two one. So there's just life. Not me doing my thing in life. Not to have a great life, a great me in life, or have a great time in life. You'll have a great time in life, just take yourself out of it. We get it all kind of confused, you know. We think that spirituality will somehow allow us to drive better on the road of life. Well, you know, will give us the necessary tool. It's not about that. And the gap between life and ourselves and how we're trying to move it is our fear usually of death. That's why we take a relief posture, in relief to life. Now, I would like to suggest a different way to work with that fear. Facing it. Looking at it. Now I'm saying this again, having already said we have to pace ourselves. But for those of you who feel ready, let's go. Which means, I'll tell you what that means. When we face our fear, we have to be willing to die. Because that's what we think is going to happen if we let down our defensiveness and protection against all the ways we try to keep death out. We try to do that because we're afraid of what's on the other side and what it's going to do to us. So to release fear means we have to be willing to face death and to die in whatever way we foresee this horrible event occurring from our fear. But that's what requires for us to look at death totally and to make the two roads one, the two lanes a single lane. What if I put nothing between myself and death? See, that is called surrender. So that we are like a sieve and the waters of life just pass through us. It wasn't blocked, dammed, protected, distorted, tributaried, shored up, banked. Looking right into it. Right into it. The vastness, the quietude, the stillness. Right into it. Now, we can take fear one by one. One fear, bring it on. Okay, I'm the abandonment, all right. Bring the next fear. We can do it. We can all line them up like that and think we're really accomplishing something. But ultimately, to embrace death, we have to end the sense of, the egoic sense of me. We have to understand it. We have to see it for what it is. That's all. We don't have to end it. We don't have to kill it. We just have to know it for what it is. In fact, when you're willing to know it for what it is, it becomes very quiet. Because it embodies itself from you not wanting to know what it is. And so just the willingness to turn to a subject like death, and suddenly you're wide open. You can feel it. Anytime you take on a subject like that, you have to be empty. You can't have a lot of ideas about it. And you can't try to project yourself in some kind of continuation through it. Like, you know, if I face this thing, heaven waits for me on the other side. I don't have any idea what waits for us on the other side. Maybe nothing. Are we still ready to face it? Maybe nothing. Maybe this body ends and everything ends. See, that's our worst case scenario. And that's what we have to face because that's what we're trying to protect ourselves from. Okay, so that's it. And suddenly there's a lot of humility when we really don't know and we're really wanting to find out. We have to be tremendously humble, don't we? We're not writing essays here. We're discovering. And what we have to do is get very quiet into ourselves. And as soon as we do, our story ends. If we know what's going to happen to us and we're afraid, fear is the story, just a continuation of it. Oh, when I die, I'm going to heaven. That's just a continuation of the same thing, slightly different environment, and you're still on and off and running. You're like the ever-ready bunny. My worst fear is seeing that bunny when I actually come on. You know, as a grad student, I was staying at a house, and the woman who owned the home where I was renting was dying. And she knew I was in grad student. She wanted to talk to me about her death, and I wanted nothing to do with her. Because I had a wonderful time studying the subject. I had a terrible time realizing what that meant, interfacing with it. You see, that's where this homework, that's where these classes take us. They take us into the subject, not as some kind of clinical safety, you know, prescription. Oh yes, I now know all about death. Well, if you have that kind of, if we gain that kind of attitude and knowledge about death, we'll be even safer in our beliefs than we are now, and more distorted in our perception, leaning further into it, because I've never seen after 27 years of holding this subject very close to my heart, I know nothing about it. That's the truth. Because I can't go into it. My mind can't go there. It stops there. Because it's the stopping point. It's the arresting point. It's absolute stillness. It's like absolute zero. Kelvin, 276 degrees below zero is absolute, everything's still. Well, that's death. 276 degrees below zero. Or whatever. It's absolute zero. Nothing goes there, so you can't know anything about it. And so there can be no movement in relationship to it. And when there's no movement in relationship to any subject, there's no story and there's no you. And that's what it means in facing your death. So I love that because you can't know beyond it. It's all supposition. I want to know beyond it. It's like a fence, you know, like... So we love the fact that some people are clinically dying and can tell us about how they left their body. But what happens then? Do they just stay in the emergency room? They ever get out of that? Where do they go then? What happens? We're never stopped. We never stop. We always want the next chapter, don't we? What's the next chapter in my story? Where will I end up? What will I do? Who will I become? That is the problem. That is the problem. That is the fear. So our beliefs fill the void. And every spiritual tradition has a different belief about what happens. It's amazing. And they're all absolutely assured and certain. I'll tell you, again, when Alan and I were in Texas, so I was setting up a hospice and she was working for the hospice as a home health aide. And one of the women that we were serving, a patient, was schizophrenic, thrashing out, used to just be a terrible patient for the other staff. And Ellen was the only person that was able to connect with her so that she was actually quiet and connected during that time with her. So she was getting close to death, Ellen, or the Eloise, the woman. And we knew that. So we left hospice, went to our home. At 2 o'clock in the morning, Ellen wakes up, says, "I don't know where I am. I don't know what I can do. I don't know where I am." Starts kind of being frantic, scaring me. I turn on the light. Ellen wakes up and she realizes that Eloise came to her at 2 o'clock, 2:06 or something, and was confused about where she was, or she wasn't herself. Turns out the next day that Eloise died at 2:06 that night. And I think that's as close, you know, where we are so, when we so want our story to continue, that we can't deal with a new environment, a new whole set of experiences, accommodating, opening, which is what we're all practicing, which is the art of meditation. Flexibility, not demanding it. Death will be simple for those who can, and terrifying for those who can't. We're in a traffic jam, period, that's it. There is no other reality but that. We go to a restaurant, 4-star, and the food's terrible. That's it. So much of our fear of death has to do with our fear of silence. Noise confirms us. That's the reason there's so much inward chatter, is that we're constantly getting reaffirmed in that chatter. We know, you know, and since there's somebody talking, there we must be alive. It's like an echo. We're out on some canyon and we keep going, "Rodney, Rodney. Oh, Rodney's out there. I heard his name. Somebody said it." And it just goes around in this chamber. And so for us to be quiet together, the echo ends. And we just have the immense vastness of the canyon itself. So we keep our story going. We keep our story moving. So when we sit down, we don't really sit down with the intention towards interfacing with stillness. We sit down reaffirming our story, mulling over the day's activities, all our life, just chapter after chapter, trying to drain some relevance from it. Do we think that has anything to do with death? Meditation is surrendering our story to silence. So when we sit down, we're not encouraging thought. We're letting thought be. We're not fighting against the story, because to fight against the story is just more story. More words that we're, any fighting, any tension, any leaning, we're just investing more reaction and therefore more me. I don't like this. The mind's so noisy. It's just more, it's just somebody's typing. It's all going on up here. Whatever you want to do, you want to do spiritual typing, psychological typing, physical typing. It's all typing. We surrender it. We die. We're willing to die to the noise. And we have to show up for that. We don't die and cringe. That's just reaction to the death. We die and bloom, wide open. We show up for that stillness. And we begin to see that fear is the strongest form of noise. When we're afraid, especially of death, we love that, because there's so much chatter in relationship to death that we're confirming ourselves in relationship to a subject that doesn't. And so, boy, will fear do that for us. In the face of death, that's why we talk so much, that's why we have so much fear, is that it allows us to be embodied when we see our demise. You see how it works? So fear is a defense against death. So we're on to that. Come what may, I don't care. I'm not going to live in this trapped box pretending. What kind of a life is that? See, what holds the fear? Because ultimately what holds all things is stillness. And if we have the courage to ask that question, we will die to all things. So you begin to see that all of the different ways that we have trained, and the words we heard during that training, non-judgmental, acceptance, allowance, letting be, all of those were orientations to our death. They are encouragements to die. Not to live in parallel lanes, but to die so that we could really have full life. And may that be so for all of us here. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, how do we sit? Do we sit with noise? Because what holds noise is far more important than the noise itself. The noise itself is nothing. But what holds the noise? What allows the noise to even be known? That's the practice. So if there are any questions or comments, be happy to Yes. The question is about the time when I experienced my own death in meditation and said that I wasn't aware at the moment of death. Was it that I wasn't aware of that moment or my whole life? It was at that moment. I put such emphasis. In fact, it was the sort of the culmination of my spiritual training, I believe, was to be present at that moment of death and to strive towards that in the best way I could up until I died was to try to be as mindfully focused on everything because I never knew when I was going to die. And therefore I would be present when I died if I had that. But it was just, it's the wrong way to approach this thing. It sounds great, gives you an objective, gives you a focus, gives you a purpose, a blueprint, a method, gives you everything, doesn't it? Gives you an intention, you can go out and be, you know, you can be a warrior or warriorina or whatever it is. But it isn't the right way. It isn't the right way. It's not the right way to meditate. It's not the right way to make this practice work. It's not the right orientation to death. It's completely wrong. It's like driving parallel to something, a car in the other lane, and you're focusing so much on it that you're going to get every single thing known about that car that's in the other lane, but it's never merging with that car. You're never allowing yourself to be at ease with that. It's really based upon the fear of what it means if I don't do that. And all of that has no place in meditation. In fact, harmonizing ourselves with death long before we die is meditation. That's the way that meditation moves. Not to get ready for the event. Krishnamurti, a teacher of mine, I probably have told you all this, but was giving a public lecture, and he says, do you want to know what it's like to die? And everybody was in rapt silence, attention like you could hear a pin drop. He says, think of the thing you love the most and drop it. That's death. Think of the thing you love the most and release it. How many of us can do that in a room, you see? I'm not looking for a show of hands. Now, when somebody dies, they are giving up everything they know. You see, when you witness somebody dying, you're giving up one thing you know, the person. But the person who's dying is giving up everything they know. So think of all the things you love. Think of your life and drop it. And you can see why it causes as much extreme terror as it does. But we are spiritually oriented. This is a spiritual oriented practice. This is what we're doing. We want to know where we're holding. We want to know where the rub is. We can't work with something in abstraction. We work with something that's right there where we see it. And there's no subject that will bring forth where we are still grasping in death. Death will show us where we are still grasping. We want to see that. I hope. That's the point. So that we can work with that. See where it is that we're leaning into it. Where the distortion, the quality of where I'm trying to build myself up in relationship to it. Where I'm trying to protect myself by bonding or being dependent upon something. How am I protecting? All of those. You begin to see, you begin to experience the resolution of that if you look deeply enough. Okay, right. Bring death on. If death will do that for me, God, I can't. What a teacher. What a teacher. And that's what the Buddha meant when he said that it was the greatest of all reflections. You want to be a spiritual person? Here. You work with this subject. Oh, no, not that one. You know, how about my knee pain? Oh. Anyone else? Yes.
I don't know if there's a question in this. It's kind of an observation. There's an experience that I'm having that continuity doesn't seem to be experienced outside of here.
Right.
And that continuity of mind is the story, maybe that you're talking about, of self that keeps me from
being. Yes. Yes. That's right. Okay, so we have to be careful here because we're on fragile ground, but she said that she's beginning to realize in her practice that when she experiences her mind, that there is no continuity between one moment and another. It's just that we fill in the gaps, don't we? We make it to be continuous by what's happened or what we perceive will happen. So we force continuity on a discontinuous universe, don't we? Okay, so that's true. And you can tell me your name and where you've been, what you're doing right now, right? So the relative way we relate to our life is also true, simultaneously. So we don't want to try to become disassociated from ourselves. We don't want to try to not have a memory where we just, you know, though we like this one man who had a brain operation, part of his brain short-term memory was taken out. A woman would come into the room, he'd turn around, introduce himself to her, although it was his wife. He'd turn back around and then forget her completely and turn back to her and say, oh, hello, who are you? What's your name? And every time he would turn away and turn back, he'd have to get reintroduced. All right, that's not what we want to become. It's to know simultaneously. The mind takes care of all that. That's its function. Its function is to be continuous, to make things continue. But if our life is totally embedded within that continuity, the sense of I also feels that it's continuous. So it's not to try to overrule one with our logic and our sense of the erratic quality of the moment and that there's nothing continuous. It's that you step out, once you step out of the moment, the sense of you becomes discontinuous. You still know the meaning of things. It's just that you're not carrying yourself along in that meaning. And so you can still, but if you're asked what your name is, you can say that, but you're not totally identified with the story as being the marker for yourself. And so if it dies or quiet, fine, it's beautiful. If it continues or moves, then that's beautiful too. And I can talk, you know, for a while about my childhood and all that. So it's not to be trapped in a story as being our soul, our sense of identification. What is it like to be able to have access to the stillness that surrounds the story and be able to enter the story like an actor on a stage when you want to, but not being held to the stage for my entire life, right? That's what the meditation does. You lose nothing, and you gain the world off stage. You lose nothing. You can be on the stage if you want. I'm on the stage right now. You lose nothing. Lights go off, you're off stage. You're not only off stage, you're off this plane. You're not held to the rules and regulations and psychological rules and regulations of this plane. So nothing is lost. Nothing is lost. If we lost something, if we became like that man, I would have looked ahead, see what my teachers were like. Sorry, I'm not going that way. Who wants that? That doesn't sound valuable to me. But to be able to set life aside, to come on and off stage, really. That's what's fun. Then it's fun. Anyone else, or we'll call it an evening?